My name is Patricia Castellanos. I am the Deputy Director at LANE, which is the LA Alliance for a New Economy. My training is not just organizationally, but my personal training, also not in public health. I'm trained as a community organizer, but also with EJ background as part of that environmental justice background. So as David mentioned, what I'm about to talk about is really going to highlight the intersection of a number of issues. So the public health issue, environmental justice issue, as well as the economic justice and labor issues. And so I'll just go ahead and dive in. Before getting into the work itself, wanted to just say a brief introduction about LANE so you all understand what we're about. LANE is an advocacy organization that's trying to build a new economy for all, and for that, embedded in that for us is a concept of sustainability. So we're really advocating for good job, thriving communities, and a clean environment for our region in Los Angeles. And really doing that through coalition building, research policy, communication strategies, et cetera. So we try to use a comprehensive approach in how we are pushing for advocacy. Now, in the past 4 years, LANE has been part of what I consider to be one of the, one of the most remarkable coalitions that I've been a part of that brings together labor, environmental groups, environmental justice groups, faith groups, and just community-based organizations, and a long list of other types of organizations. We came together to tackle one sliver of what you all have heard from the rest of our panelists, and that sliver is just the trucking industry as part of the goods movement system. And we know, as you've heard from my other panelists, my other colleagues, the goods movement system has enormous repercussions on our communities, on our environments, and also on our workers. So we set out to take one bite out of that system and use it as an opportunity to test how we build coalitions, test for ourselves how as a coalition we can wage campaigns, how we can develop policy, and doing that in hopes that not just that we learn from each other and become stronger as individual organizations and coalitions, but really doing that in hopes that a victory along these lines leads to greater victories in other parts of the system, within the goods movement system, or even outside of that. So I'll talk a little bit about the problem that we were seeking to address as a coalition, and by the way, the coalition is the Coalition for Clean and Safe Ports. I know it's up there, but I'll mention it as well. The problem, and I'll talk about it nationally and then hone in on the implications for LA and Long Beach. So nationally, we're talking about 95% of the 100,000 trucks that are hauling goods in and out of our ports fail to meet US EPA emission standards. So this increases pollution by about 1,000% in all of these communities. 87 million Americans live in port communities that violate federal air quality standards. So again, public health, environmental issues. But also there are tens of thousands of drivers or workers that are driving these trucks that are hired or classified as independent contractors. They're earning between $10 to $12 an hour with no benefits and no right to form a union. So these are like broadly what we consider to be, or what we identified as the problem that we were seeking to tackle. The root of the problem we saw as trucking deregulation. And as I go along, hopefully we'll be able to make that connection a little clearer for you. But what trucking deregulation did in 1980 was essentially shift all of the burden, all of the costs of operating the trucking businesses onto the individual workers. And so no longer was this an industry that internalized the cost of doing business. Instead, it externalized it, put all the cost onto the drivers, and also, as you've heard, onto communities who are suffering the public health impacts of it. And again, the majority of the port truck drivers are misclassified as independent contractors and do have to bear the financial costs. And that means they have to purchase the trucks, pay for the fuel, pay for insurance, everything that you can imagine these individual drivers are doing. And so, you know, when you have individuals forced to bear that cost, then we have a significant number of unintended consequences, which we will talk about now in a little bit. So what that meant for us in LA and Long Beach, the environmental crisis, again, not to be redundant, but it's real, and as far as trucking is concerned, you know, the ports of LA and Long Beach, as with ports across the country, is where trucks go to die. You will find the oldest trucks operating at the ports. And so when we launched the campaign, on average, trucks were 12 years old, but there was also records of trucks dating back to 1941. And so you can imagine the impact, environmental and otherwise, that these trucks are having on our communities. The trucks were responsible at the time for 30 to 40% of NOx and diesel particulate matter, and they were having a disproportionate impact on our communities because of the exposure. And so trucks, port trucks in themselves are not the biggest contributor to pollution in the LA basin, but these are, unlike ships and unlike the equipment on the ports, these trucks, as you saw through other pictures, are going through our communities, are, you know, passing through our schools and our freeways. We see them and come into contact with them more than we do ships. The public health impact, we estimated, based on the California Air Resources Board, that 3 people die per week, or were dying per week, from truck-related pollution. Asthma rates were more than twice the national average, and no surprise, drivers faced serious exposure because they were, you know, driving the trucks, idling behind another truck that had their engine on, et cetera, and so they were facing it around the clock. So just talking a little bit about, a little bit more about the crisis for workers. So we had brewing was an environmental crisis and also an economic justice crisis and a crisis facing drivers. And both of them, in our view, were inextricably linked. So it's just some stats on when we first started the campaign, the conditions for drivers. So we're talking about 80,000 nationally, about 16,000 at the time, just in LA and Long Beach, averaging $28,000 a year, working anywhere between 12 to 16 hours a day, less than 10% with health insurance, no pension, majority immigrant workforce in LA, as well as the other ports across the country. So the nationalities differ considerably, but for the most part, this is an immigrant workforce. So again, the issue of misclassification is key here. The drivers pay for the truck, the fuel, the cargo insurance and truck liability. So the cargo that they're carrying to the warehouse to Target, they have to pay for that insurance. They have to insure that cargo. But they don't see any of the benefits. So, you know, in LA and Long Beach, the ports of LA and Long Beach are one of the greatest economic engines generating wealth in our communities, yet the workers that are working there every day don't see any benefits from it. And again, these workers are unlikely to be covered by workers' comp, no disability insurance, no unemployment insurance. So we just went through one of the worst economic crises in our history. You heard of people applying for unemployment. These set of workers didn't have a right to that insurance because their employer was not paying unemployment insurance. And so, again, this is a crisis that, you know, had been brewing for the past 30 years since deregulation. Again, the impact on drivers. What we found is that these drivers, I put here that their impact around the clock, they not only work in conditions that expose them to environmental hazards, they also live in these communities that you've heard of. So the majority are concentrated in communities that are along the transit corridor. And, you know, the pay structure, I think, again, just leads to unintended consequences. When they are forced to get paid by the load, they take shortcuts. and that impacts our communities. When they are making, and I'll just show you this, just to show you the what it comes down to, the bottom line. This was, again, a couple of years ago, a driver actually, after working more than 40 hours a week, came home with $1.76 check. And then the other is a different pay stub. And again, it just shows you, while they made gross $6.56, after fuel of $456, they end up with nothing. So if you were making this, what kind of truck would you buy? Right, exactly. So that's why for us this was, you know, the problem was so much about how these workers were classified and the issues, the consequences of deregulation. You know, we weren't ones to just say, oh, there's a problem. We all agree that there's a problem. We actually, as a coalition, came together and pushed for a solution. And one of the things that I'll say before going to that is that one of the other biggest problems related to the port trucking industry, that there was virtually no oversight of the industry. So trucks were going, companies were sending trucks on and off the ports, and the port authorities had no idea who these trucks belonged to, what companies they were. They didn't know how many companies really operated at the port, and they would always give just average, you know, estimates, but never knew exactly who was coming on and off their ports. And so what we wanted to do is, in fact, create some oversight, and resulted in a huge victory for our coalition in 2008. The Port of Los Angeles adopted a Clean Trucks program that immediately banned 2,000 of the dirtiest trucks from the ports. It's now up to 10,000 dirty trucks have been banned from the ports. It put over 7,500 clean-burning trucks now that operating at the port. And as of, I think, last week, over 94% of the gate moves made are made by clean-burning trucks. So this is clean diesel, LNG, for the most part, clean diesel. And so far has reduced emissions anywhere between 70 to 80% from trucks. And they also, the Port of LA did require that trucking companies own the trucks, employ the drivers directly, take full responsibility for their equipment, and make the companies bear the cost of buying the new trucks. I'm going to go through these really quickly. And again, it began in Southern California. Coalitions began forming in New York, New Jersey, and Oakland, and pushing their ports to adopt similar programs. No surprise. industry fights back. The American Trucking Association filed lawsuits, sued the Port of LA and Long Beach, who adopted a weaker program. They were successful in getting a temporary injunction and enjoined much of the Clean Trucks program, and there were severe impacts coming out of that. It stopped other ports from adopting similar programs because they were not about to get sued by anyone. And, you know, companies quickly went back to business as usual, except, you know, which meant that they were, again, shifting the cost onto the drivers. Only this time, we weren't talking about a $5,000 dilapidated truck. We were talking about a truck that cost anywhere between $75,000 to $200,000. And this was a cost that drivers were forced to bear. And you know, what we began to see is that the environmental gains were slipping away because drivers were not able to afford the maintenance on these trucks, and poorly maintained trucks are become polluting trucks within no time. As a coalition, we stood our ground. The Clean Ports Act of 2010, we nationalized our battle. You know, ultimately, it was a federal statute. It was federal deregulation that was at the root of it. We, you know, decided that we were going to try to take a run and pass legislation through Congress. Right now, we do have a bill. It's the Clean Ports Act of 2010. You know, talk to me in another month, and I'll let you know what our strategy is post the election of a couple weeks ago. But we're not, I think, at a point where we're ready to give up that fight. Ultimately, the federal law does need to change to allow other ports to adopt this program. Our environmental partners are defending the program in court. In August, we had a great victory in court as the judge ruled that the program was completely legal. And this is the roller coaster of our campaign. Industry, of course, appealed that decision. And the judge did decide to reinstate the injunction on the requirement that drivers be employed pending appeal on the merits of the case. And then we're just continuing to monitor the program as it exists currently in LA. So first, just a couple of key takeaways. There is a winning formula for us. Despite the fact that we're facing legal challenges brought on by a very powerful industry, we did win a huge victory by adopting the Clean Trucks program, and it was because we brought together this broad coalition. It's a campaign that's really important. It will lift 88,000 workers out of poverty, and it's an environmental justice victory that could save hundreds of lives, improve thousands by cleaning the air in low-income communities. But again, it speaks to the future of what's possible if we do build strong coalitions, strong broad coalitions. It does strengthen the possibilities for cooperation around other issues. And we did have one clear example of that when the Teamsters actually reversed their position on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge drilling. So that, again, speaks to the possibilities of coming together. So that's it. Thank you.
So we did want to end with some good news on that front. But I think the other takeaway is the battle is still on because as Penny pointed out, the particulate matter is we can't stop at 2.5. It's the ultrafines are just as harmful, and there's no barrier which will keep that out. So that's an ongoing issue and struggle. So with that, I want to thank our panelists for their presentations. And we are open for your questions and comments. Yes, sir. This is still the largest county in the U.S.?
It's the largest in California. I don't know if it is in the U.S.
It is? Okay.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, sir.
Angelo, the 710, how much of that is elevated and serves to cut off the communities from,
So the proposal is to build a dedicated truck lane, or lanes. Some of it will be elevated, and actually some of it will actually go underground, depending on what part of the 710 they're at. But we're hoping that the outcome and the alternative that would be selected would be a fixed guideway or some type of zero emission brake corridor to use that dedicated truck lane versus diesel truck.
Yes, Amy.
I have two questions. One for Martha and one for Angelo. Martha, we're from Detroit, and I'm curious, the maps you show where the trucking happening, Detroit doesn't show up on that, but we're the largest, trucking route to Canada. So I was curious about the reason for that. And then my question for Angela had to do with the HRA that we conducted, which focused, it looked like, on cancer risk. And I was curious about the decision to focus just on cancer rather than the multiple health impacts, which it seems could have been a much more powerful statement to cumulative.
Okay, let me repeat the questions, because I'm not sure whether they're recording this. But so the first question is why didn't Detroit, with its major international crossing, show up on the maps in terms of sort of the flow of diesel trucks as a port? And for Angelo, the question is why the HRA only focused on cancer? So, Martha.
There are multiple maps that show Detroit in a very big way. The one I chose to show today doesn't show Detroit.
We didn't know you were
So the truck corridors, I think this particular map, and I'm looking at my black and white here one right now. This was an industry-generated map. I have another map that actually shows Seattle and Tacoma show up very large, And as it's spewing out of that, the trade actually flows from the Northwest ports, actually comes straight across, you know, and through Chicago to Detroit and eastward. Detroit's a really great example of how there may not be a seaport, but there's a border, a number of border facilities. So, there are tunnel projects, bridge projects, and a number of things that Canada actually pays for in Detroit that facilitate goods movement. Right. So it's hard to capture. Hard to capture all of what we are hearing from all these different communities around in one single map. It's necessary, and we have to kind of figure out the tools to do that and the analysis to do that by. But I think it's only by stitching people together. But it's a very good point.
I was just going to say there was an NPR story on Laredo, Texas, yesterday or the day before. And I don't know how that shows up, but again, it depends on exactly what the map is.
Okay, and the HR?
In terms of the HRA, there was a lot of work that went into actually getting them to adopt that as an approach to include in the environmental review. And if we would have had it our way, we would have included a whole bunch of other health outcomes to be included in the HRA. But instead, we decided to kind of like pick our fight around the HIA to have a more quantitative analysis. Mm-hmm. So the HRA is a good decision, and it's a lot of hard work. We wanted to put more of our resources into advocating for HIA versus another quantitative analysis. We wanted to go with the policy.
Can
I
add
something? One comment on that?
Yeah.
We've gone through a lot of EIRs out with these distribution centers and stuff. And one of the things that we're seeing happening is while they do them and they identify significant health impacts that they can't not, with a straight face, they've now gone to overriding considerations, which the courts are upholding. So the economic supposed impact or benefit are washing out any health impact. So our HRAs and HIAs, are going to be trumped by the economic impact.
I was also just going to mention that the there's a lot of use of HRAs in California. This is the first time one has been, that Caltrans has agreed to do one on a highway project. So it's kind of a big deal. But the use of HRAs in California often really look at these levels of cancer per million so that you're able to compare. And they talked about some preliminary results recently on the 710, and we were pretty shocked because they always say you build the new freeway, the traffic goes faster, the trucks are cleaner, the pollution's lower. And we've really pressed them on this near roadway impact. And they said in the first result of the HRA, they're finding an elevated cancer risk near the highway. So it's actually the first time that we've had Caltrans admit to something like that. So we think it, in combination with the HIA, will be a good tool.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for a very important presentation. When you compare what's happening in the States with Europe, where there's much more use of electric rail, in the analysis of the cancer rates, for example, in France, where you have trucks, but they're much lower on the highway, less frequent than in the States. And the other thing is, what kind of action needs to be done from APHA, because this is very important stuff. How do we need to act politically and trade unions and public health groups and so forth in the future?
So what should APA and other aligned groups do on this particular issue?
One of the things that I see is happening within APHA and a lot of the health organizations, certainly all the transportation organizations, people are looking at obesity and walkability and the types of issues that will help to improve people's lifestyles and hopefully reduce disease and obesity in the future. But this type of issue very seldom is getting into that mix. So people are talking about you know, building communities closer together in town and being near a transit stop, but and being able to play outside and walk. But nobody's looking at the fact that these kids can't walk outside where they are living with the highways and the trucks and everything right next to them and the rail yards next to them. So somehow that has to be part of the new federal transportation authorization, but it also has to be, I think, part of some of these resolutions that APHA and other organizations come out with.
Is there a resolution?
Well, there are. There's a big transportation and public health program that APHA is working on. And when I've sort of glanced over it, there hasn't been very much in there about the issue that we're talking about. Now, that may mean that we need to get involved in that, you know? So, because it really is being driven by the lifestyle and obesity concerns, which are very serious, but that is the main focus.
And I think in general, just like on a local level, that we need to really inject the dialogue with health perspective on policy debates that are related to transportation and other related issues that are holistic. So not just like that this freeway is gonna, you know, relieve congestion, what are the impacts throughout the community and for the workers? So, you know, it's looking at it from a holistic standpoint, not just that we wanna provide services to the communities to reduce their health burdens, but how is the policy debates gonna have an impact on those as well?
Let me just mention, I mean, when I go back to New York City, and the trucks are rolling through these streets, and they're blasting off the diesel. It's much cheaper to go through the streets and take the 59th Street Bridge than Triborough Bridge, so they go through neighborhoods. Okay, what can I go back to my community, and when I get to my local Democratic club, what can I give them? Do you have anything to pass out?
Well, I think, you know, recognizing that the closer you are to the diesel source, the greater the health risk, especially with the ultrafines and the vapors, that they fall out pretty quickly. So one of the things is creating some buffer zones between those sources. The other is truck routes, and really being forceful and making sure that you have truck routes that take the trucks away from where people are, away from schools, and away from those sensitive receptors. That's one thing we can start with. There's some other, you know, vegetative buffers, which are, you know, the barriers which actually absorb some of this. There are some stopgap stuff, but I think ultimately we've got to take a stand on diesel. It really is.
Do we have anything to go home
with? I can point you to organizations.
Yeah, there's. Can you give them this report? You know,
there's a coalition in New York, New Jersey, that's working on this, which we're also supporting. And, you know, some of the trucks are, in fact, illegally traversing through neighborhoods. And so part of the plan also is, to the extent that they're illegally traveling through the neighborhoods, you know, you can try to monitor that activity and try to stop it through, you know, enforcement as at least one avenue.
People are interested in like case studies and different resources around the country. You know, one of the things that came out of the Impact Projects conference a couple weeks ago was a huge mailing list. And so if you're interested, just leave us your card or something and we can add you to kind of the distribution list so that you can actually get on the website and find out who across the country is doing different things. It's by the quickest, right?
Yeah.
It's quite amazing.
Yeah. So there's a copy of the summary of the report that Martha and Andrea and others are publishing. There will
be some of the chairs up here that you're not sitting in.
Yeah. So, but there will be the complete report will be also distributed. And so, if you're interested in that, let us know. We intend to that is Foundation intends to use this as a vehicle to at least inform the public about this particular problem because it's pretty hidden from view. If you don't know it existed, you wouldn't even know it's a problem. So the idea is especially to get this out in front of healthcare and public health community so that they become aware of this. What are the policy implications and responses, and what are some other solutions? So I think here you were the first, and then in the back.
So I was just curious if, because you mentioned that a lot of the people that actually live in these communities are employed then do you sort of come up against this conflict of like jobs and economic development and is that ever,
right, so jobs versus health. How do we?
Yeah, but do the individuals sort of recognize and if we're trying to get rid of all of these warehouses, are we then cutting ourselves out of the picture of the economic picture?
Well, we've in our work, we look at and are organizing through the community, and the workers are part of that community. So you can't organize in the community without addressing those concerns. And so, when we were fighting some of these warehouses, the truckers were part of our group because they also didn't want these warehouses close to their families. And they had the feeling that, I'm sacrificing my health, I know I am, but I'm not willing to sacrifice my kids. And so they helped to fight some of that to keep the warehouses away from the houses. With the Warehouse Workers United, we're working with them because it's the same families again. And while they're doing some leadership development with their workers and education on what's going on, what they're exposed to, we're also doing that with their families. And so you have not only just a worker being educated and understanding what is happening and how it all fits together, but also the family as well. And so it makes it much stronger. Yeah, there's going to be some conflicts because there's, some neighborhoods that just don't want any more warehouses. You can't take any more trucks through here. And people who are looking for a job. And most of the warehouse workers are saying, I don't care if I work in a warehouse or I work someplace else. I want a job. I want to be able to support my family. And what they're finding is that the jobs in the warehouses are like the independent truckers. They're, making $10 or less an hour. They have no benefits. They're temp workers. They're hired through temporary agencies. So they have absolutely no rights of any kind. And they're working in horrendous conditions. The warehouses are not heated or air conditioned. They shut the doors because they're afraid their workers will steal things. And so when you get to 110 degrees out in our area, those people are baking in these buildings. And they have no right to challenge that. And OSHA doesn't cover that.
And actually, I'll just add, I don't think it's any surprise to anyone here. The jobs versus, health versus environment debate is ongoing. I think that's something in our coalition that we try to debunk, right? In our case with the Clean Trucks Program, it wasn't about good jobs or clean air or healthy communities. It was us saying, you can actually have both. It's going to cost a little bit more. It's going to cost industry a little bit more. And so thus, and I think in all of our cases, what you'll find is industry then begins to fuel this division further. And when you have an economic crisis, particularly for workers and even for labor unions, that becomes an argument that's easy to embrace or becomes easier. And I think that's something that as a coalition, we've tried to say like, no, the Teamsters said, we realize that these drivers, these workers live in these communities, and we want to make sure that we have a holistic plan. The other thing that I'll say is just when we launched the campaign, and as you're talking to the workers, the drivers that are driving these trucks, they saw themselves, most of the time you would talk to these drivers, and they saw themselves as part of the problem. They're like, I'm driving this truck that's killing my kids. And they would say, I don't want to be part of the problem, but I don't see any other way. And so they were very cognizant of that, and like they felt it really deeply. And in fact, when we did a poll of some drivers, most of them put the environmental issue above the issues of wages. So it's an important issue for workers as well.
Okay, in the back.
Yeah, I got a couple of questions. So I appreciate the presentation. That was pretty comprehensive. But one question is around, there's a set of regulations that deal with passenger vehicles and gasoline and greenhouse gas emissions for passenger vehicles. So is there a set of regulations coming out of California that may impact the national legislation around diesel, the content, the electrification process? Is there anything like that?
So is there
most of the stuff that's coming out of the state agencies, mostly incentive funding to reduce diesel emissions. So there's no real regulatory measures for reducing diesel. It's mostly incentive funding and programs to there's necessarily any national implications for addressing diesel.
Well, there is a federal law which mandates that all diesel trucks by a certain date, right, have to be clean diesel technology.
Right.
But I believe that they grandfathered in all the existing trucks. It's something like that, right?
Right. So, and the phase in there's a lot of issues with that particular mandate, and it's behind. I mean, you know, behind the times in terms of California's promotion of their regulatory measures. Now, the state of California has truck rules, both drayage and statewide truck rules. But again, it doesn't get to the core of diesel exhaust. It has a reduction, so it's really going towards the filtered cigarettes versus the non-cigarette
right.
approach.
And it's the volume versus the toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's
it's the lesson of
reducing volume, but we're not reducing toxicity.
Yeah. And I will just add, the ports, the stuff is bad enough, but you know, school buses, by and large, are still diesel. So if for nothing else, and you have children who ride in school buses, diesel ought to be a concern of yours. Is Celeste in the back?
Last month, Ford, I'm a member of Occupational Health and Safety Section and the Environment Section, and thank you so much. I respect your work very much. And I think that your presentations demonstrate that there are things in the short term that can be done, and I endorse the idea of us getting rid of diesel altogether. But I think we also need to think, as a community of people, why do we need all these trucks anyway? What is all this stuff that we are buying? And it really gets to upstream thinking. I just moved outside of Austin, Texas, and every single exit, there's another Kohl's, another Target, you know, it's all of these box stores, and we have been convinced by corporate America we need all this stuff, and we don't. And until we address the issue of consumerism, and what is all the stuff that we're sold on? We're never gonna, whether it's gonna be diesel, it's gonna replace with something else that then we also find out, you know, is not healthy.
That's right.
Well said. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just to kind of play off of that, I'm glad you brought up this idea of consumerism, because Penny, when you were talking, the comment you made about, you know, it's important to make cleaner trucks, but in the long term, that's not going to be enough. We have to have something else. It really reminded me of this lesson that they lay out in Cradle to Cradle, where they're talking about like product design and making a product that's recyclable. While that's a valuable thing to do, that's not enough. We need to look at why we keep consuming these disposable products. And I guess I just want to revisit the question this gentleman posed earlier, in that are there other alternatives for transporting goods? Because I don't think trade's going to stop anytime soon, and as you have more people, you know, people consume more goods. So have you been looking at alternative transportation systems, and what do you see the feasibility?
Let me add to that. If you go to France, for example, all the major cities do not permit truck deliveries during the daytime. Ouch. Okay. After it's only, you know, before the people had to work and so forth. So it reduces the amount of trucking. Well, of course it goes through at night, but.
But I think the bigger picture is out there looming, and that is, you know, we become reliant not only on foreign oil, but we become reliant on foreign products being shipped in. We're not making anything for ourselves. And especially we're not providing sustainable communities who have their food grown locally, who have their products made locally that meet the requirements of that community. Instead, we just get all of this junk stuff that comes in. And we have no control over it, so we end up with poison dog food and poison baby toys and, you know, all kinds of things. And so I think it goes to a bigger picture. If we want to reduce our reliance on foreign oil and fossil fuel, why are we doing an industry that is totally reliant upon that? I mean, ships, trucks, trains, the whole gambit. So we have a separation between our policies that we're pushing and what we really need. And there doesn't seem to be any recognition of that. We continue to push the old dirty industries, and this consumer mentality, which we're not a consumer nation much anymore. I mean, people don't, they can't afford to buy the stuff except for that wealthy top part. You know, the rest of us, with the unemployment that we have and stuff, people are not buying, and they keep saying that's why our economy is not recovering. Well, maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we need to do this shift. And I don't remember in the discussion in the 90s when we moved to this logistics industry as our main engine for the economy, anybody ever talking about getting rid of the jobs of our farmers, of the agricultural land. Nobody had a discussion about where are those workers going to go. We just did it. You know, they just took over. And so at some point, you know, we need to stop having the corporations decide what we need to be doing, and we need to decide as communities what we want for our people and what we need for our people and what is sustainable.
So we've run out of time, but I do want to ask one last question, since I have the mic. So to what extent was public health an ally in your efforts?
You know, in all of the warehouse hearings, in all of the discussions on the rail yard, we never had a public health department present at all. They still do not acknowledge that as a public health issue. They don't want to get into challenging the railroad. Who does? I mean, you know, who wants to take the part that is there are the researchers. And I have to say that USC, UCLA researchers there have been a godsend to us. They've provided the facts and the ammunition that we've needed to go forward. We found out facts don't count because they do it anyway. But they've provided the validity there. And I think that has been extremely important. We're still getting a number of people stepping forward to study and look at what's happening, but we aren't getting the advocacy from the public health community that we've got to have. You know, and at some point we have to step forward. If just a portion of the people advocating on obesity would step forward and advocate on this, we would make a great headway.
For LA Long Beach, I know we're being recorded, but the Long Beach Health Department, zero.
Yeah.
Zero. In fact, they won't get involved. For the LA County Health Department, we've had some involvement with Paul Simon, who is a very high level in the health department around the 710 issue and the HIA issue. But it's pretty slim pickings in terms of public health involvement in this issue.
Okay. So I hope one takeaway is that, you know, we need to first work on public health ourselves. So with that, I want to thank our speakers. Thank you. And thank you.